Listening to Resonance 104.4 FM and on digital. This is The Sound of Photography, and I'm Frank Watson. As you know by now, we deal with all things photographic. I'm very pleased to have here Gareth Gardner, my special guest. Welcome to the show, Gareth.
Hello. Yeah, thanks very much for having me, Frank. Yeah.
Right, let's introduce what Gareth does and what he is. Gareth is a photographer, journalist, gallerist and curator based in Deptford, London. He specialises in architecture, the built environment and sense of place. He works with architects, designers, PR consultancies and public organisations. In 2019, he opened the Gareth Gardner Gallery, focusing on photography of architecture and the man-altered landscape. Recent projects include Route Book, based on Ian Nairn's travels in England in the 1950s, and more recently it's curated On the Hedge at the Royal Horticultural Society at Widsley. This was an exhibition about hedges and soap topiary. So more on that later in the show. If you want to look at more images by Gareth, his website is www.garethgardner.com. Gardner is G-A-R-D-N-E-R. OK, we're going to start at the beginning, because at the beginning you were planned to be a civil engineer, is that right?
That's right, yeah. I studied civil engineer for 4 long years at university. But while I was there, I decided that the actual math side of it, which is a huge element in civil and structural engineering, wasn't really for me. And I was much more interested in the sort of planning and policy aspects of how we plan our infrastructure. Mm. So while I was at university, I kind of took the decision that I wanted to get more into writing. Mm-hmm. And I was already a keen photographer at that point and had really documented my teenage years with a tiny camera. So I have lots and lots of photographs of being drunk as a teenager.
Photographing yourself being drunk?
Well, possibly. Lots of parties in the sort of teenage social circuit, really, sure, more than anything else. Yeah. And then after finishing university, I worked for only about 6 months as a civil engineer. Mm. I think there's a wonky car park somewhere in the New Forest that probably floods every time it rains that might have my signature on it. Right. And it was very interesting, but I was really keen at that point to get into writing, and managed to kind of bully my way into a job on New Civil Engineer magazine, which was a big weekly construction publication at that point.
Okay, so photography began to enter the scene, but before that, I think you became a journalist, is that
That's right, yeah. So what was great, though, is I got trained to be a journalist in that first job, but also they were very encouraging of reporters taking photographs for stories, but also just to learn how visuals go with text. And we were very lucky. I think we were the last trade publication in the UK to have staff photographers. I mean, it was even then in the mid-90s, it was a luxury. Yeah, I can't imagine any of them have in-house photographers anymore, and we had two at that point.
Wow,
plus a dark room. So we were always able to grab film. Mm. And once I think I got a nice job editing a supplement for the magazine, and the editor very kindly bought me my first film SLR at that point. So I sort of progressed from a Canon compact camera, which I thought at that time was a bee's knees, to an Olympus SLR, and didn't look back, really.
Right. So what sort of articles would have been covered in that? I mean, was it fairly dry stuff, given it was civil engineering?
Oh, no, not at all. I mean, it's endlessly fascinating. Right. Bridges, tunnels, dams, writing about these epic construction projects. Mm. Quite often, when they fail, that's a time also when you do a lot of investigative journalism. Oh, so I remember being flown out at no notice to Lisbon because the new bridge they were building there, I think it's the Vasco da Gama crossing, had temporary collapse during its construction, and quite a few people died by falling off the bridge into the river below. And I was told I couldn't come back unless I got the news story about it, which was one of my most terrifying news experiences. Yeah, yeah. And news is very like that. I think it can be quite aggressive.
Right.
And
so
I,
it was almost a crime scene, wasn't it?
I was there for about 3 days, and after day one, I was no longer allowed near the site. I think they realised they had to lock
around.
It down because they had their investigators coming in and things like that. But I sort of learned at that point that I was more interested in the kind of more expanded features side, sort of delving more into a subject, and also the architectural side. I was really interested in the structures of buildings and how buildings work, and was very keen to kind of write more and more about the building side of it rather than the infrastructure, roads and all of those things, that side of it. So eventually moved on to an architectural magazine and then moved into interiors. Well,
so did you get into the magazine on your journalistic skills?
Yes, yeah. Very much so.
So you were, you know, you obviously were a confident writer. I mean, did that come naturally or did you learn those skills?
No, I think it does. You have to have a natural aptitude for that kind of thing. And quite a lot of the trade magazines back then, they'd have a policy, whatever sort of expertise they were covering, of employing a mix of journalists who have a journalistic background and then specialists in the field that they're reporting about. So in that case, we had trained engineers and trained journalists on the magazine, and they would cross-fertilise. So there was a lot of support and assistance given to train people up so they were fluent in both of those languages.
It so they were brilliant. Really supportive of your
incredibly so. Yeah. I mean, it was amazing. I think it had the best start, really, in journalism, and also to be encouraged to take photographs as well. It was like ticking all those boxes, you know. It was absolutely fantastic.
Sounds like a dream job.
It was great. I mean, I was very, very lucky. Mm. But I already really enjoyed writing. I'd won a few writing prizes. I was, you know, entering competitions and things. I think I must have, while I was at university, really enjoyed writing the essays rather than doing pages and pages of highly technical maths and things, which is what the other side of engineering.
Right. So this led to you studying photography.
That's right. In my final job, when I was editing an interiors magazine, I somehow managed to wangle a feature reporting on a short course at London College of Printing on large format photography, obviously, which is back then, back in the early noughties, about 2001, was still the main way that architecture was being photographed professionally. So 5x4 format.
That's analog.
Very analog, yes. Yeah. I mean, it was really at the very, very beginning of digital, if at all. I mean, I seem to remember we had very primitive computers running Photoshop, but in terms of cameras, it would have been very analog still entirely in the architectural business. So I did a week's course learning how to load dark slides and the camera movements to correct for perspective. It just blew my mind. It was so exciting. So I think I literally gave my notice in as soon as I went back into work and said, I've got to retrain. I'm going to do something different. And left that quite, you know, reasonably comfortable job and trained to become a photographer.
Right. So was that your only education from that short course?
No. I then went back to LCP to do a years-long course in... they do a professional photography practice course, which I think still runs in a different guise. Right. And that was very much focused on kind of learning all the different technical aspects of photography with, you know, plus a fair smattering of the sort of contextual side of it. But since then, I was very lucky because I already had really good contacts in my world of architecture. Right. So it really helped me get into, become, to photograph for people. And I could also write and photograph for people as well,
So you're just expanding your CV and, but also going back and picking up on the contacts.
Exactly.
You already
had. Yeah. And when you edit a magazine, you get to know a lot of different people. So, and I was still writing for magazines, but I still do occasionally, although I only write about photography really these days. But, and I think as the years have gone on, I've just spent more and more time writing about photography and learning about the, you know, the contextual side, the creative side, the artistic side of photography. Although I'm still, you know, absolutely passionate about all the interesting kind of technical solutions that are out there for, especially for architecture. So it's all very interesting.
Right. So in the early days, what sort of photographic jobs were you given? Because I would imagine it's pretty competitive. I mean,
it is. It's a small world. I'd say that more than anything else. It is not a big pond of people. Most of the people are fairly similar in their backgrounds. A lot of them are former architects who happen to be very good at taking photographs. And a lot of people have been knocking around for quite a long time as well. So I think it is quite a hard business to get into. Mm. It's quite a sort of exclusive little club. And one of the things I'm really keen with the gallery to do is to try and break that down a little bit and get different voices, because I think quite often architects kind of want people who are a bit like themselves to photograph their projects, to sort of reflect them in the best light. Mm. And I think it's good to get different voices. And sure. Unfortunately, these days, we don't have the big budgets on magazines that we used to have, where we could pay photographers to objectively or with their own viewpoint photograph a building. It's always the architects paying them.
So what magazines were you initially working for? Was it things like the AJ? And
So I've written for the AJ before, but Blueprint magazine, which was a big title at the time. I did lots of big features for them. Design Week back in the day when they still ran. Building Design, where I used to work. Mm. FX magazine, where I used to work. But yeah, I mean, when you work as a photographer architect, your work tends to appear everywhere once, if it's a project that lots of different magazines want to pick up on. But what's really happened, I think, definitely over the last 20 years, is the actual direct commissions from magazines have really gone down, which is a shame, really.
Yeah, and why is that?
Just they don't have the budgets anymore. Right. But I think if you look back at really famous architectural photography from 60s, 70s and 80s, people like Tony Ray Jones, photographing for the Architectural Review.
That's right.
You wouldn't get those kind of commissions really these days.
They're too left field.
They're too left field and they're too expensive. Mm. I mean, even then, they weren't commercially successful. So I don't think they helped to boost the circulation of these magazines. But I think in terms of the sort of photography canon and how we look back on these magazines, now they're the shoots that really stand out and have had a life beyond the actual magazine.
Well, Tony Ray Jones, was he doing the East End or was it Docklands?
He was all over the country. So that was part of the, and I'll talk a bit about this a bit more with the E&N, but he was part of a series the AR did called Man Plan, which was a series of very photojournalistic issues of the magazine where they commissioned non-architectural photographers to record elements of architecture and the environment. And he went around lots
with
of...
With more of a social bent,
wasn't it? Much more of a documentary bent. And they used a lot of really interesting people. Tony Ray Jones is the most famous of them, but there's a lot of really good people on there. And he went to lots of different housing estates and photographed them, including in Deptford, where I am, the Pepys estate. And he also went up to Thamesmead. And he travelled out of London as well. He was basically given kind of like a free brief.
So he could make up his own projects.
He could roam around and come back with material, which is just incredible. The chance to have that now would be just amazing.
Right, we're going to play the first track. You've chosen, what have we got here? Belle and Sebastian, Judy and the Dream of Horses. Do you want to comment on that or should we just let it play?
You can just let it play, but this was the soundtrack to the last exhibition that I put on at the gallery with a photographer called Danilo Muru, who absolutely loves Belle and Sebastian as well. And it kept us in high spirits.
Judy wrote the saddest song. She showed it to a boy in school today. Judy, where did you go wrong? You used to make me smile when I was down. Judy was a teenage rebel. She did it with a boy when she was young. She gave herself to books and learning. She gave herself to being number one. Judy, I don't know you if you're gonna show me everything. Judy, I don't know you if you're gonna show me everything. Judy got a book at school. She went under the covers with a torch. Fell asleep till the first morning. She dreamt about the girl who stole a horse. Judy never felt so good except when she was sleeping. Judy never felt so good except when she was sleeping,
We'll be right back.
We can test and do whatever you want, but you will be disappointed. You will fall asleep with thoughts in your pants. Judy, you're just trying to find and keep the dream of horses. And the song she wrote was Judy and the Dream of Horses. Dream of Horses. Dream of Horses. Dream of Horses. The best looking boys are taken. The best looking girls are staying inside. So Judy, where does that leave you? Walking the street for a mile. Write another song about your dream of horses. Write a song about your dream of horses. Call it Judy and the Dream of Horses. Call it Judy and the Dream of Horses. Your dream of horses. Da 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 ba. Your dream of horses. Da 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 ba. Your dream of horses.
You're listening to The Sound of Photography. I'm continuing to speak with Gareth Gardner. We're shifting radically to a project that involved the architectural journalist and critic Ian Nairn.
That's right.
Some of you might have heard of him, maybe not, because he produced a infamous piece of writing called Outrage in about, is that 1954 or 55?
55.
And out of this, this piece was called Outrage, and basically it's his attack in the mid-50s on the way England was becoming a sprawl of urban and suburban sort of blight. Is that right?
Yeah, I think it was very well titled because he was really outraged by what he saw. And it became, again, we're back on the Architectural Review again, a very, very famous issue of that magazine. It was subsequently published as a book that also sold very well. And he coined the term subtopia, which is the mix of two words, suburbia and utopia. But I think ironically, but it became such a kind of buzzword in the mid-50s that questions were asked about it in Parliament. Prince Philip used the term at a speech to, I think, the Civic Trust or one of its forebears once. And he really did capture quite a lot of the public consciousness at that point. And I think he was also riding on a tide of interest after the war when so much rebuilding was going on and new estates were being thrown up and rebuilding of bomb cities, where people were interested in what their towns and cities looked like and in the what's called townscape of places. And really he was sort of channeling that kind of fear and interest in what was being constructed.
I suppose we have to go back to the idea that many of the cities were badly bombed. There were these great gaps where buildings had been pulled down because, but also because of buildings that were in such bad condition, it was almost easier to pull them down than refurbish them.
That's right.
So, and people could see that things were going to change, cities were going to rise up in a different shape or form. And I guess traditionally that made a lot of people uneasy.
I think uneasier, but I think there was probably more acceptance, there was more excitement about change than perhaps we have now. You know, the sort of white heat of technology, the excitement of people moving from overcrowded slum-like conditions into buildings with large spaces and big windows. I remember my mum telling me about moving into a prefab at one point and it just amazing how spacious it was and how much natural light came in compared to where they'd lived before. So I think it
was So prefab was almost a luxury for them.
Exactly. I think
which
you know,
is incredible.
Exactly. I mean, and I think the people, the very few that remain now, the people who live in them, you know, still love their
prefabs. I always remember there was prefabs down in Elephant Castle. And I think it was entirely inhabited by old rockers or the Teddy Boys.
They're having a great time there. Winter gets a bit cold in them, I think.
Yeah,
but
they had a little community, you know, with their motorbikes and...
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah,
that sounds great. I went to visit, I think there was the last lot in Catford as well, the Excalibur estate, and that was just an amazing sort of people kind of DIYing how they lived.
Yeah, the make-do-amend sort of philosophy.
Exactly, which was really heartening, I think. I quite enjoy that when people kind of improvise around their houses.
Exactly, yeah.
So anyway, so Nairn, the centrepiece of Nairn's outrage was a journey that he did from Southampton all the way up to the glamorous Gretna Green wedding capital of Britain. He did write further about Scotland, but really the main emphasis was his journey he did in his Morris Minor. Armed with his Leica, he wasn't a professional photographer.
Leica camera, we should say. Yeah.
Yes. He was an amazing writer, very thought-provoking, very accessible to people, which I think made his audience much bigger than just the sort of professional architectural audience. And he went on to have a broadcast career as well. And I think something of a, not to sound too disrespectful, a professional alcoholic. So his love of pubs really shines through everything he writes. He was really keen about pubs. There's a fantastic book called Nairn's London, which writes about London in the 50s and 60s and all the buildings. And there is quite an emphasis, you notice after a while, on the drinking, the watering holes of the capital.
I was amazed that he included an Irish bar called Ward's Bar, which is was below the new Trocadero.
Oh, right, yes.
And it was an Irish bar. And it was in a basement, and it was a lot of Irish navvies. And I used to go there occasionally, and there were quite often fights and people smoking certain stuff. And at one point, the barman came over and told this young Irishman to stop skinning up, as we used to say.
Yeah.
And the response was, well, I'm not going to say it. Yeah. And the barman just crawled back behind the bar. And
he'd done his duty.
Yeah, he knew things would erupt. I mean, it was full of character.
I don't think he was really afraid of where he went to. I mean, doing this journey through England as well. I mean, I think he planned it. This was before motorways. I think this is the thing that's really interesting, is that the landscape was very different there. So
before car culture had really blotted. You know,
yeah, but I think he could see it coming. He could really see it coming.
I mean, he's got this thing about car parks, isn't he?
He loves car parks. I mean, he's interested.
Did he? I thought he hated it.
Well, I think when I say love things, I think there are things that he loved to hate. So wire fences, aerodromes. Yeah. So, you know, England was covered in lots of Air Force bases and so on.
We should say at this point that he'd been a pilot in World
That's
War
right.
II. And
yes.
I didn't know this, but I think that says a lot about his topographic view of looking
very
over
Very much
from England.
Looking over the air. Yeah,
yeah, and seeing, you know, a different perspective.
I think he had that bigger picture of what was happening. And one of the reasons why I wanted to follow in his footsteps was firstly that he began in Southampton, where I was at university, a city I know very well, and also has been written about a lot by people like Owen Hathley, who's a fantastic writer about towns and cities. And then it goes through Warwick, where I was brought up as well, sort of like Middle England, totally Middle England. Yeah. So I felt I had some connections with a couple of points on the route, which kind of gave it a greater resonance for me, I guess. So the plan was to recreate the journey exactly as he did it, not in a Morris Minor, in a terrible clapped out Renault Megane, but it was tremendous fun just driving and looking and seeing what happened. And it was a very different landscape to the one Nairn encountered. There weren't any retail parks, giant out-of-town barns with Tesco's inside, or those endless housing estates with little twiddly cul-de-sacs. These are all
I
new.
I mean, what he preempts is the idea of each high street looking the same. You know, little could he have known how it is now, you know, this idea. Because he's really interested in this idea of the individuality of place, isn't
That's
he?
Right.
That you go to different towns and each town has a character and it has unique shops. And as we all know now, it doesn't matter where you go in England, you know, you see the same old brands.
Exactly.
To the point of exhaustion, really, and lack of choice is more important.
I think he famously said that in the future, the end of Southampton would resemble the beginning of Carlisle, which were the two kind of main stops.
In other words, they join up. You wouldn't know where
you wouldn't know where you were. The regional differences in the architecture and the shops and all the things that he celebrated would be erased. Mm. The other thing that he really hated, municipal flower beds. He was really outraged, and lampposts. So,
there's a whole set of pictures of just lampposts, isn't there?
There was almost. I spoke earlier this year with the 20th Century Society, which is a great organisation that lobbies for the preservation of important 20th century buildings and landscapes.
Did lampposts come within their 20th century?
I think they do, yes. But I spoke about his sort of photographic influence and the way he catalogued municipal flowerbeds and lampposts. It's very almost like the German duo, the Beckers, this sort of typology. He was really interested in looking at the variations in concrete lampstands. He was outraged by the concrete lampposts on Warwick High Street, which are no longer there, but I can remember them as a child being there.
What was wrong with Warwick lampposts?
They were very chunky.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, very kind of brutalist. I mean, they'd probably be listed now, I don't know, but they were very utilitarian and were very dominant on the view of the high street. And I think it kind of detracted for him from the beauty of all the Georgian and Tudor buildings.
So. I mean, the other thing was that he was really railing against the amount of signage, wasn't he?
Yes.
I mean, I think he, you know, coined the expression a landscape of words, which we all sort of know and accept. You know, we don't really, we just take it for granted. There is signage everywhere, whether it's in the country or in cities
these
days.
I think that's right. I mean, I think we are potentially better than lots of other countries.
Is that right? Really?
I mean, if you sort of suddenly arrive in Tokyo, you know, billboards everywhere over every building. So I think we're slightly tamer. Yeah. But what happens, I think, is this proliferation of kind of non-approved signage and, you know, Traces 50 today on a roundabout. And this roundabout is sponsored by a local garden centre, that kind of thing.
So you get local solicitors was one of them, I think.
And I think also solicitors always seem to, I don't know what the relationship is between roundabout plants and solicitors. That's probably one for a future exhibition. And I think also this kind of duplication all the time of signs on sticks. So when I've seen schemes, urban schemes, where they've actually kind of tried to edit and rationalise a landscape, it can make a huge change to how you see it. And also, I don't think he really predicted the cluster of cars as well, quite the number of vehicles that would clog up.
I mean, we're
streets.
Talking about when he journeyed, as you said, pre-motorway, you know, this idea of A roads and B roads. And you sauntered along in your Morris Minor at 30 miles an hour and you had a chance to look. You know,
where's
a motorway, as we all know, you don't see anything really.
I was very lucky because I was brought up by a household where my mum and dad, they still do this. They will quite happily go out for a day trip and take in about 9 counties and see 28 different National Trust properties. So,
what hope was there for you?
I know, I had no chance. And when I was young, they had this amazing Ford Corsair in metallic tan with teak interiors that was just like, my mum still says it was the best car they ever had because it had huge bouncy seats and it was just wonderful. Fins on the back. And so a lot of my early experiences are driving around, looking through the windscreen of this.
Did you have the back seat to yourself?
There was a dog that would be upsetting everybody. And then my sister arrived 5 years later.
Oh, so right. I think so I didn't have the whole.
It was declining rear seat territory, unfortunately. But so I think I got used to travelling and looking a lot, even at a young age.
No, I remember, we never went abroad. I didn't go abroad till I was 18. And my dad wouldn't go abroad. He didn't want to fly. So it did mean we went around England a lot, like you. We travelled a lot. And I actually think when I did travel abroad, it became more special, you know, wasn't it?
I think so. And I think also, I mean, I always get shocked by people you meet who have lived, you know, around, you know, places all their life and have never really travelled anywhere in the UK. And it's just like, it's full of so many amazing places.
Yeah.
Most of them are surrounded by retail parks, but the actual places themselves are pretty special. I mean, it's just brilliant for exploring.
Let's go back to your project. So how many miles is it, Southampton?
Oh, it's about 400 miles.
So how many, did you just do one trip?
One trip, and then I've revisited various elements over the years. I mean, it still stays semi-live, and there's like a phase two.
So how many days did it take for you to get from Southampton to Carla?
Just over a week.
Right.
And that was with many, many stops.
I was going to say, it must be stop-start all the time.
Stop-start. I was very lucky. I went with a friend of mine.
And were you driving or
So I drove, but my friend Kate, who sadly passed away, but she was in charge of holding a notebook and looking at things on my behalf while I sort of looked and tried to drive as carefully as possible. But we then did stop at sort of major points where we knew there'd be interesting things. And it was partly a lot of checking maps, Google Street View and all of those things beforehand just to really get a sense of what we might discover on the way.
Did you have a shopping list of what you were looking for based on the book, or was it more serendipitous than that?
I tried that, and people quite often ask, well, did you try and recreate anything that he took? But he took very close views. I have done that with other projects, but in this case, I just wanted to use his kind of spirit, his way of looking at it. I tried to channel, but looked at what the contemporary landscape held, because you don't see a lot of Air Force bases and white fencing
anymore. So were you defined
anymore
by his subject matter, I suppose? Is what I'm
not
saying.
Really. I think his subject matter is so broad. It's the urban and rural landscape. So I didn't feel at all constrained by what he'd done beforehand.
Right. And in then, you know, in a way, there's been a sort of resurgence
massive
of interest,
one,
isn't
yeah.
there? Yeah, I know Jonathan Meade's called him a poet of place, which, you
that's
know, coming
right.
from Jonathan, that's a good compliment.
And I do recommend, I mean, a lot of his books have been republished over the last couple of years yeah. with introductions by Travis Elborough, who's a fantastic mm-hmm. writer. And so I think it's, you know, if you haven't read any in then, it's really worth picking up a book and seeing yeah. what made him so angry about everything.
Yeah.
He also wrote some of the Pevsner Guide to the Buildings of England, and they are just beautifully written. And he really knew his stuff. He wasn't trained as an architect, but his yeah. knowledge and his way of describing buildings yeah. is a real lesson for everybody, I think.
Yeah. I mean, you can see on YouTube his journeys in the Morris Minor, can't you?
Yes.
And he is eccentric. I mean, he verges on hysterical. You wouldn't be surprised if he burst out crying. He gets so upset when looking at certain buildings and towns.
And he's not an easy listen either.
Oh,
his voice,
I find his voice
very easy to listen to.
Yeah.
It's quite a sort of
manic.
Slightly grating, manic voice.
Yeah.
But I think the stories that he was putting out there were really important.
So good, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, we're going to play, I think, quite a bit of a fitting piece of music by Kirsty MacColl, A New England. You're listening to Resonance 104.4 FM and on digital, and this is still The Sound of Photography, and we're still talking to Gareth Gardner.
That sounds so
and
positive.
And I'm still Frank Watson, so all is well with the world. We're going to talk hedges, as in hedges in gardens.
I bet you didn't see that coming, did you?
You better start telling us about whether you have an obsession with hedges or whether... Well, how did it come up? I'd half wondered whether, as you drove from Southampton to Carlisle, you started to sort of focus on the ubiquitous nature of hedges.
Exactly. You've nailed it on the head there, Frank. Well done. Well spotted. A couple of the shots that I took on the trip alerted me, kind of subconsciously, that I like hedges, and I hadn't really realised that before. And so we had a gap in the schedule a couple of years ago at the gallery. We tend to have about four exhibitions a year, and thought, a few friends of mine were like, you've been going on about hedges for a while now, and perhaps it's time to actually do an exhibition about them. And once I stopped laughing, I went ahead and we did an open call, first time I'd ever done an open call, thinking if we got 8 or 10 people, that'd be enough to fill our bijou little gallery space in Deptford. And so 500 submissions later, I realised that we were potentially onto something, and then it became this huge operation to sift through them, get hold of the files to print them up, and curate the exhibition to a digestible form that would fit within the space, which was actually great fun, very intense process, and also to look at some of the narratives that came out of that, which was a really good way.
Had you asked people to write about their hedge when they, or the pictures of their hedge?
They had to just submit a very small caption, because otherwise I think we would have ended up really being tied down. And I think quite often people get very nervous about writing about their work. So what we then did is I went back to the selected photographers and helped them to form words and encourage the message that was coming out, and it was absolutely tremendous fun. So we ended up grouping it into three sections: one about topiary, one about urban hedgerows and shrubberies, and then one about the disappearance of the cities into the landscape. So the sort of edge city, liminal spaces, which is the kind of lingo that gets used all the time in photography. People are obsessed with liminality, and so it kind of created three really nice broad subject areas, which gave us a lot of scope to squeeze things in, and so we ran that exhibition at Deptford, and as a result then the Royal Horticultural Society got in touch. It had loads of publicity.
Let's stop a minute.
Sorry, I'm stopping.
No, sorry. I mean, it's interesting to, I always think that hedges is a particular English obsession, but I mean, I think, you know, what is the hedge doing? It's obviously about boundaries and property and who can look through other people's windows. You know, it sort of has quite a sort of varied sort of role within the sort of garden, doesn't it?
That's right. What we weren't doing was trying to produce a set of images of different types of hedge. And this is a different privet, and this is a yew hedge. It wasn't kind of like an informative exhibition for hedge fanciers.
So it's almost the architecture of hedges.
Yes, it was more about the sort of social, cultural, economic, all of these different factors that kind of underpin why we grow and enjoy hedges. So everything from the privacy that hedge provides, which may be the realm of somebody who's a little bit shy or wants to defend themselves from their neighbours, to the sort of exhibitionist pampas grass in the front garden, showing off your wonderful topiary that's in the shape of a squirrel, that kind of thing. So I think it does talk a lot about how we live and how we like to display or hide ourselves.
I mean, also, I think, 10, 20 years ago, there were a lot of neighbourhood disputes over a particular type of hedge, the Lorelei, isn't it?
Yes.
Lorelei?
Hedge disputes
have
are still...
Have I got that right?
Leylandi. They're still very live. There's loads of them. There's a hotbed of disputes in Lincolnshire. That seems to be one of the main areas where we have lots of disputes, including murders, shootings, suicides, all relating to hedges. One where a chap was actually urinating on his neighbour's hedge every day, which went to court.
And why would he be doing that?
Because he hated the hedge so much. So quite often it's about
stealing.
With
the intention of killing it.
Yes, very much so. Quite often it's about the stealing of space and light from your neighbours.
Which is understandable.
And also it has got resonances with politics, because hedge growing is one of the areas where there are quite few regulations. I mean, it's quite onerous to try and get your neighbour to force them to take their hedge down. So it's become a symbol of freedom, our English right to grow a hedge in a shape or form that we want.
It's interesting that you said a lot of the disputes are in Lincolnshire, one of the flattest counties in England.
Yes.
And, you know, with all the light and space that you would probably need, and yet perhaps...
But also politically, very pro-Brexit, yeah. Very much about you know, the Englishman's house is his castle, that kind of attitude, I think, as well. So I think you see places where people are quite territorial about their spaces. Mm. There's a fantastic, you can see it on Google Street View in Sheffield, a hedge that was growing between two houses and one neighbour just cut it down the middle. So when you, it looks like an optical illusion on Street View on Google, because it literally is half a hedge very neatly cut down the middle,
side, right.
Which kind of visually, we didn't have it in the exhibition, nobody photographed it, but it does very visually show the kind of result, the visual result of, you know, dispute like that.
Because you actually found a picture of mine that I don't think I even knew about your
hedge. It's a fantastic photograph, right?
Which was taken in, I can't remember where it was.
Was it Essex?
Essex, yes. That's right.
We had quite a few from Essex, actually, in the exhibition, which is interesting. But your photograph, Frank's photo, is amazing. It's of a hedge looming over a bungalow and totally out of scale.
It's about three times the height of the bungalow.
It's
and
enormous.
It looms over the bungalow to the point where... Well, it's almost something macabre about it.
It's very interesting watching people visit the exhibition and what pictures they kind of settle on. Yours was definitely one that people really enjoyed looking at, but people getting really angry at what the, oh, I don't want to be living in that house, can you imagine?
Yeah, they invest their sort of emotions
exactly.
into the picture.
So, yes, you were definitely causing people to get quite irate at the exhibition, but in a
that.
Good way.
So, yeah, we've done a quick shift here. So originally the show was in Deptford
That's
at
right.
your gallery.
Yes.
And then how did the Royal Horticultural Society pick up on it, or did you approach them?
No, I mean, I think that's something I want to do more in future, but we got approached because I think it got a lot of publicity at the time, again, which was quite unexpected. We got in lots of different press around the world,
right?
And The Guardian did a really nice big feature about the hedges, so suddenly you know, you become known as Mr. Hedge and everybody starts sending you unsolicited hedges in your, I mean, they're still coming in. It's just crazy all the time. Yeah. And people coming to the gallery saying, oh, I didn't realise I was the only person who liked hedges. So I felt like we'd formed a support group for the hedge and topiary photography community, which is much bigger than ever I expected, I have to say.
I think you would probably be the chair of that society.
The president, the lifelong president, definitely. Yeah. The RHS picked up on it and asked if I'd be interested.
They approached you?
Yes, they approached me.
Which is nice, isn't it? Rather than you having to hustle.
Absolutely fantastic. Yeah. No hustling involved, which was an absolute dream.
So they obviously could see that there was a sort of, you know, something they could pick up on. And
well, I think it's an exhibition with a sense of humour. I think there might be a general perception that hedge photography is a little bit obvious in terms of a trope. But I don't think so. I think there are a lot of stories that really can be told about us through hedges and shrubs and things like that. So I was quite proud that we managed to get all this publicity. And I think they then saw that it would have broad appeal for them as an exhibition. Yeah. And they're keen to try and extend the demographic of visitors to their gardens and make them relevant to people
of all
ages.
And I think you were, didn't it? You had a huge amount of visitors.
Yeah, every time I went back, it was mobbed, especially it was incredible. People were taking it again too seriously, as I say. People kind of very upset about the horticultural nature of some of the hedges, how they'd been neglected or pruned badly, or the cultivar wasn't one that they would recommend. So that was really interesting.
So they were experts.
Expert
there.
Audience.
Yeah, yeah.
And we had it in the gallery space at their garden in Wisley, just outside London. Well worth a visit. If you can ever get the chance, I mean, not for the exhibition because it's sadly no longer on, but it's an amazing garden with beautiful buildings in it. And it was just the perfect environment. And we also then were lucky enough to be able to commission a photographer to do a special set of pieces for that exhibition based around RHS Wisley. And that was a real pleasure. I've never done that kind of commission before. Mm. And it was really enjoyable to work with somebody, very talented photographer called Anna Kruger. And she just did a splendid job using analog photography techniques of the gardens and using the plants themselves to process her images.
Okay. Well, that sounds great.
Taking us quite a long way from architecture at that point. I think as far as I'll ever go.
I don't know. I mean, you know, it's hedges do have... I mean, I think what we haven't talked about is particular images. You know, perhaps you could give us a sort of flavour of the types of bit. I mean, the one that I remember off the top of my head are hedges that have been made into the force... suits of playing cards.
That's right. An amazing photograph by a California-based photographer called Enoch Koo. And it's great because this is the other result for me was that I've made friends all over the world who love hedges. So he really had been travelling around California and Palm Springs.
We should say this is an international.
Yes, well, it became international. So he was photographing. He photographs a lot of sort of cypress trees that are growing in crazy gardens that have got out of control, but also topiary in America, which has its own tradition, really based around Walt Disney and the Disneyfication of hedges in America. So it's very much a sort of 1950s phenomenon, because they first introduced them at Disneyland and Disney World. So really interesting.
Went to Disneyland and then went to their back garden and started copying the...
It's copying the hedges. Yes, exactly.
And what are the characters that... I've never seen this. So
I haven't seen any. We didn't get sent any Disney-related ones, but there is talk that, you know, these sort of figures of Disney characters were really popular for a while in the 50s and 60s. we had an amazing set of topiary from Mexico City, where topiary is very much like a community-based project in the city, and there are frogs and dogs and all sorts of amazing shapes. So it was incredible to see how
inventive
people are, but also how this is a phenomenon around the world as well.
It's not just an English thing.
Okay,
we should play some music. We're going to play Cities by Talking Heads, if I can. It's the Sound of Photography, and we're still talking about, various architectural issues. And we're going to move on with Gareth Gardner, and he opened a gallery of his own in 2019. And I think you see this gallery as being quite unique. Why is that?
That's right. I think, based on the research that I've done, I think it is the only gallery, definitely in the UK, but potentially further afield as well, that only specialises in photography of architecture and place. It's the architectural element, I think, that gives it that kind of uniqueness.
And define what you're looking for in, you know, what sort of work have you shown in the past? Ooh. So how many shows have you had since 2019, roughly?
Oh, probably about 12, 15, something like that. We try and do about 4 a year. And what we try and do is show people who haven't particularly shown before very much, to try and broaden the number of different voices. And we mix we've had a few group shows, and group shows are a really good way to kind of get more people involved with the gallery. But it's a small space, so solo shows work really well for us as well. And it's very much down to people who are happy to really get involved with the exhibitions and submit themselves to the curation process, which is a really interesting process, I think.
So do you curate these shows?
I've curated everything there so far. Right. I'm really interested in the idea of having people start to come in and show their own shows in the space, which I think would be really interesting. But it kind of, part of the space is also my own workspace, so it's just kind of negotiating those sorts of boundaries, really. But it's interesting, people get on the list to do an exhibition, and they come with their little bundle of photographs that they want to show, and I always say, well, stop there for a minute, let's go back to the foundations of your project and what you're trying to say. What are the narratives and all the images you've taken, and what the relationship between the different images that we're choosing are, so that we can really tell a good story in a small space. And that's something I find really interesting and enjoyable to do.
So give us an example of a sort of show you would have had in the past.
So this summer we had a really beautiful exhibition by Danilo Muru, who inspired Belen Sebastian earlier, of photography he'd taken across Sardinia, which is his native land, although he's lived in the UK now for about 20 years. And his work is a mix of architecture, townscape, and also the people that he encountered on the way. And it talks about his own personal relationship with the island and how he feels about it, and coming to terms with having lived and been brought up in Sardinia. And that was interesting because I think Danilo had his favourites, and I kind of pushed him to expand the remit of what we looked at and include different ones. And the relationship of how the pictures sat together became really important in that exhibition. And what was interesting with that one is that I actually printed a similar version of the exhibition for him just beforehand that he showed actually in Sardinia, which he curated, and looked very different in the space that they had, which was a very old space. And it was
Similar work, but a different space and a different audience.
Exactly. And kind of like how that does change how...
Different dialogue.
Different dialogues between things. And that worked really well. And I think it also made it much more interesting for him to kind of revisit them rather than just... What I didn't want to do is just replicate that exhibition. I wanted to make it really work for the space.
Because here it might be seen in terms of something maybe, I don't know, exotic, whereas to go back to Sardinia, it would be about things that were familiar to people who lived on the
exactly
island,
and I think, if I was to show photographs of housing estates around Warwick in Sardinia, that would have a different response.
Certainly would.
To if I was to show it here. So I think yes, that was very much in my mind. So that was kind of, we often work with single artists on that process. And then we've done some group shows, obviously The Hedges. The other one that I'm really proud of is a project about the Pepys Estate we were talking about earlier in Deptford, which is one of the biggest social housing projects of the 60s in London on the riverside. And one of those that Tony Ray Jones visited for Man Plan. And the Royal Institute of British Architects up on Portland Place had an exhibition about the Man Plan programme. So I decided that we should do our own show at the same time, looking specifically at the Pepys Estate, but commissioning new work by people to look at how that estate is today, but also having more archive material for people to look at as well. So I'm very interested. I do a lot of work professionally photographing exhibitions and cultural spaces. So in a way, the gallery is also a bit of a laboratory for some of those things that I learn about on those professional shoots, and creating an entire experience that people find rewarding and something really for them to chew on. It's not just going in and seeing five pictures, but you really learn something about, the locations and the cultures of these places. That was really good working on a quite short form project, but with different photographers to...
So you were working with the RIBA,
programmed it to run at the
so
same
that they
time.
Conjoined.
And when you have a small gallery space, it's always really good to get involved with what else is happening in the world at the same time, festivals, that kind of thing, but also that case to sort of tie in with an exhibition that was taking place.
Footfall.
Exactly, to get people to come down and see it, because a lot of people think Deptford's far away, which it isn't.
Okay. And, well, what else can we say about the gallery?
It's a really fascinating process working on that alongside my day job as a professional photographer, and we are always looking for new projects. So people out there don't have to be a professional photographer to show there. We're desperately keen to look at new voices. We do portfolio reviews for people as well. I'm very happy to look through people's work. And we try and be a really inclusive space so that everybody who comes there feels super welcome and not intimidated.
Do you get funding for this?
No, we haven't done. I'd like to. That's another thing I think that you have to be quite expert at negotiating, and that obviously comes with various different strings attached to it as well. But for me, it's just a great opportunity to meet different photographers, something I really love, and engage with people in a different way.
Right.
And the space that we're in, we're part of Enclave Projects down in Deptford, which is an amazing group of gallery spaces, project spaces, artist studios, and one of the linchpins of the kind of Deptford very vibrant art scene that we have down there.
Okay.
And it's just really enjoyable engaging with the different artists and curators in that space, and having a public frontage to the gallery as well. So I just love it when people just walk past, didn't realise we were there, and come in and have an experience. That's just fantastic.
I mean, the Hedge project must have drawn lots of people. I mean, I became aware of your gallery space because of that Hedge project.
Yes, definitely. That drew a huge audience. Yeah.
Put you on the map, I would imagine.
Think so. I mean, actually, the very first exhibition we did there, that I showed a few of my own bits of work just to sort of soft open during COVID. But then we had the work of three different architects who came together for a project called Morley's or Less. And if you don't live in South London, you might not know that Morley's is this amazing chain of fried chicken shops in South London. And they had diligently over years photographed all of the non-Morley's, but had taken their inspiration from Morley's branding and name. So it's like a fake Morley's exhibition. And they had captured nearly 50 of these, which we showed in grids.
So these are like fast food, like what I know, like Chicken Cottage. You see them like Chicken Cottage, Chicken Valley.
Exactly.
I've never yet to see one that's called Chicken Universe, but I'm sure there must be.
I think they're all over. But there were lots that there have been lots. There are fewer now that were inspired by Morley's, which is a very successful chain. So there were things like Metros and Monley's and Merley's or copying the typography.
Yeah.
So they catalogued these very diligently and we showed them. And what was interesting about that is that we had a whole different audience for a show like that, and it's amazing. I didn't know about the world of chicken shop lovers, and it's like a real area of absolute fascination and passion for people. So we had all
people going just to visit them.
There's lots of famous like chicken shop YouTubers and TikTokers, and so we had that audience as well. So the opening night was quite a riot, as you can imagine. It was just incredible.
Were you offering food?
We didn't actually. No, that's one of my regrets, I think, is not to do that.
Yeah. Okay, well, I think we're coming to the end of the show. I'd like to thank Gareth Gardner for coming in and talking about, well, such a range of subjects. It's been really enjoyable.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Well,
it's been absolutely wonderful. Thank you.
And thank you to Milo for producing the show. And we're going to play out with a bit of Kraftwerk, which I think sort of fits neatly with what we've been saying. And goodbye for me. And I'll see you in a couple of weeks when we have another guest.
You're listening.